What's up? This is Natty P. I am here with episode number 436. I don't think it means what you think it means. And I'm here with my co-host, Mike Miller. How are you tonight, Mike?
Well, I was doing okay until I had to do a live stream.
Yeah, that's...
This computer's just kicking me.
Our regular computer was sick tonight, and so... we seem to have technical difficulty when that happens. So, actually, we're kidding. One of our co-hosts, Ricky Gantz, is under the weather, so please pray for him. So, for the show, Mike, I read a news headline that says Oregon County issues face mask order that exempts non-white people. Crazy times.
Of course, yeah. They must have better immunities than white people do.
I have heard. Well, let's not get into that. That's a historical fact and trivia that you can look at on your own. You can Google immune systems and the reason behind choosing who they chose for slavery. Anyway, our topic tonight is related to that. The title is Top 10 Words That Don't Mean What You Think They Mean. And so we've come up with a list of 10 words that are common in the social justice / critical theory vocabulary. And these words are words that are common to us that sound nice, but they come with a very specific meaning attached to them, and it can be confusing at times. So go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. Now while we'll talk about things, we've already discussed that heretical groups use the same language and have different meanings. So while we'll talk about kind of more at a popular level with everyone, this is not new to our culture. This is stuff that has been happening around for a while.
Right. Just like you said, I've worked with Mormons before and even Jehovah's Witnesses, but the cults, when they talk to you about God, they use the same terminology. They use grace, they use faith, they use gospel, even in God. Did I say God twice? They use those words, but they don't mean the same thing that we mean when we say them. And with this newer, you could call it a cult or religion, there's various aspects of cult and religion to the social justice movement. We see like acts of religious penance as white people get down and shine the shoes of other ethnicities. We see methods for atonement. We see a concept of original sin, which we'll get to a little bit later in the list. And so why don't we just go ahead and get started? I am going to go ahead and read the list for us. Number one. Diversity. Number two, inclusion. Number three, equity. Number four, justice. Number five, racism. Number six, privilege. Number seven, oppression. Number eight, white/ person of color. Nine is gender. And number 10 is reconciliation. And so these 10 words all take on a specific meaning in social justice and critical theory. So the main theory behind all of this is called critical theory, which from critical theory, it's basically a way of looking critically, believe it or not, as we've seen. Some think it is a useful tool, and it is useful for certain things. And from critical theory, we have critical race theory, critical gender theory, critical all sorts of, and this isn't a this isn't like I have a theory about how the world works, like the theory of relativity. It's more of a methodology of doing things.
I think it is a theory, but just in philosophy, it also works out in a way in how we act. So it's a theory in that they try to explain the problems in the world, and then based on upon that theory is based upon basically a worldview.
Sorry. All right, so let's start with the beginning. Big concept in critical theory is a concept called standpoint epistemology. And basically what this means, this undergirds the whole thing, is that certain people who have similar experiences of the world, actually, Mike, would you define the word epistemology? Because I know what it means, and I was about to go right into it. So define epistemology for us.
I was going to ask you to define it, because you just threw it out there. No, epistemology is basically the study of truth, or where do we get truth? How do we find truth? Probably as Christians, you may know a theory of epistemology as reformed epistemology. Not that it's reformed in theology, it comes from Alan Plantinga. But there is this idea of epistemology is the study of truth. How do we know truth? Where can we find truth? So when you add standpoint epistemology, it's basically, it's my truth based on my perspective.
Right. Yeah, so the way I typically define it is how you know what you know. And to summarize what you said, is standpoint epistemology is I know what I know different than you know what you know, based on my lived experience. So my experience of the world has me learn truth in different ways. And so that undergirds all of this, which moving into our first three words, we're going to kind of tackle in rapid succession. These are what expert James Lindsay calls the Holy Trinity of critical theory and social justice. These are diversity, inclusion, and equity. Sometimes you might hear equality. What do you think diversity means, Mike?
I mean, when I think of diversity, and probably maybe leaked in because I've had to go through diversity and inclusion training, not voluntarily, but idea is that you have different people with different backgrounds coming together to do something, to work on a project, to develop new rules, laws, whatever that may be.
Right. So typically we would think of diversity as different stuff. And so if I have a room full of 10 people, typically one would think that I have a diversity of 10 different opinions. But the way that critical theory works, and the reason that we've talked about standpoint epistemology, is because it's really not, it's a diversity of opinion based on ethnicity, based on lived experience, where generally all people who look a certain way have a certain lived experience. And so we are trying to represent everyone's lived experience equally, when we want to make sure we include a woman, a man, a white straight man, a cisgender female, however, all these different terms, we want to make sure these different epistemologies are represented, so we have all the facts, because we don't all see the same reality. The first time I actually heard the word diversity, or trumpeted as this important thing, I was in my undergraduate education at a liberal university. I didn't know the difference between liberal and conservative university back then, or any of this stuff. I simply was placed in an atmosphere where they were giving me Kool-Aid to drink, and I didn't know the difference between one flavor of drink and another. And so the way it was used in my education was, I was a teacher in training, and so we had to do student teaching, and we had to do student teaching in a diverse school and non-diverse school. And so, just to give you an example, I began to think, honestly, that this was just the new euphemism for minorities. So, like, for example, there is a school, the school where I went is primarily white. It would not have been considered a diverse school. However, in the town where I live, there is a school called Akron-Buchtel, and the student population there is over 99% Black. And so that school, though, according to my college, would be a diverse school. Same makeup, same percentages, yet one's diverse and one's not diverse. So these words don't mean exactly what we think they mean. Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I think about where a place I used to work at, Fortune 50 company. So not a small company by any means. And to improve our diversity, there was, they started to hire people that didn't know how to work with tools, in a place where you need to learn, you need to know how to work with tools. But because we were primarily Caucasian white males, though we did have some females that worked there and some non-white people who worked there, that wasn't enough to do it. And so they brought people in to help diversify the plant, which I'm not, some of them brought in, they learned quickly, you know, that's fine. Like, there's a point in which if you think they're able to learn, be able to do it, have the aptitude for it. But then there's others that just weren't cut out for that type of work. It's really dangerous. It's hard. It's demanding. And so you see this, this push for diversity, when I think considering that you should, that we should be looking, and because we weren't diverse enough, they brought in a whole bunch of people, and they denied people jobs because of it, that were already, they were contract, but they wouldn't hire them on because they need to help diversify, even though they were, knew their stuff, they were there. And so you do have, so that was kind of my experience, at least with diversity. Now, I went to a conservative school. I went to a conservative seminary. And for the most part, I've worked in places either diversity isn't much of an issue, like in the Air Force, because they just accept people as long as you can fill out the proper waivers and whatnot. And they're not trying to meet quotas. Or, you know, working in other places. That just wasn't always an issue. But that's kind of the first, and this is especially when we start getting into some of these others, where I started experiencing more of the critical theory, intersectionality, and really started to see that in my own, now creeping in kind of more in my own life.
Okay. move on to inclusion. I guess we can kind of, we've kind of picked up on inclusion a little bit. So inclusion isn't basically, whenever I think of including someone, this is our second word, I think of not excluding someone, right? However, it's more in critical theory, it's more like what we just talked about, right, Mike? With inclusion, it's not just not excluding them. It's not, you know, just not discriminating or saying certain people aren't allowed. It's making sure that those people are put there on purpose, right? It's more, yeah. It's going the extra mile. So that we kind of touched in your experience there, just the almost textbook of inclusion. So it's not just what we think about inviting all people, like maybe the disclaimer that was in the fine print with employers hiring is an equal opportunity employer. Now, inclusion means that you not only have to be an equal opportunity employer, but you have to go out and get them. We see this with the, I don't follow sports that much, but I think it's called maybe the Rooney Rule. In the NFL, there's a rule in the NFL. It might be called the Rooney Rule. That might be a different rule. But the one I'm talking about is every time they go to interview a coach, even if they know we're going to hire Mike Ditka, he's not been around for years. We're going to hire Mike Ditka and bring him out of retirement. We know this for a fact because the Bears are slumping and we need fans. They still got to hire – or interview, whether they're going to hire him or not, whether they know already who they want, they have to interview some minority candidate. Now, it'd be one thing if a minority applied and they would, you don't want to exclude them, but now you have to make sure that you go include one, find one, go out to the highways and the hedges and find one of these diverse people to include.
Yeah. And we see it a lot with the LGBTQ plus Z community.
Right.
And it's not just being part of, like, bringing them and being part of it, as you mentioned, but there's also that element of accepting who they are regardless, unless you're one of the oppressors. Right. So a white, male, Christian.
Straight.
Those you're allowed to kind of exclude.
Right.
In the actual proper definition of the word. But so, yeah, even in the idea of inclusion, it's not just merely letting them work, which I don't have a problem with,
no.
Whatsoever. But it's, as we start seeing now and with recent Supreme Court decisions and other, what they're advocating, it's not just you need to support them or bring them in. You have to support them. You have to virtual single them, and also you have to promote them. In fact, I was just driving by downtown Louisville, and a prime example is this is a headquarter building here in downtown Louisville. You can see it off the interstate, and they have a rainbow streamers running down the front of their building. Because they're inclusive. They're, right. You know, and it's not just bring them in. It is that propping up that if you don't support it, you're exclusive.
Right.
Which I always find the irony because that would be them excluding someone. So they're not really inclusive. You kind of, you know, we think about redefinition. To be inclusive is to bring them in, to be a part of it.
Right.
How they define inclusivity is that you have to support. You can't disagree with the zeitgeist, to use a fancy word, the winds of the culture, the movement of the culture. If you disagree, well, now you're excluded. Well, that's not being inclusive.
Right.
I mean, if you... And so it's always kind of funny and ironic that they push for inclusiveness, but they are the first to exclude people who disagree with them.
Right.
That
was one of the words, since I was whittling down to 10 words. Tolerance didn't quite make the cut, but that's a word to throw in there right now. Along with inclusion, is the concept of tolerance is defined similarly and exactly how you just stated it. So moving on to our last of James Lindsay's holy trinity of critical theory concepts, the last one is equity or equality. And so these things go hand in hand, tailor-made to fit hand in glove. Equality sounds great. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. This is language that is familiar to us based on our country's seminal documents. It is a concept that is familiar to us Christians, because we know that here there is no slave or free, Jew or Greek, man or woman, that everyone has equal access in Christ. This equality, God made them all in his image, male and female. So this equality is something that sounds very nice, but it's not quite that nice, is it, Mike?
No, because you'll have, again, it's the redefinition of it.
Right.
We can say that everyone is equal at the foot of the cross.
Right.
That we all bring our sins, and there is only one Savior. No one, in a sense, in God's eyes, does not deserve justice or less justice. He sees all people equally condemned for their sins. And so there's that sense. But when, with at least what I've seen here with equality, it's not that everyone's equal. Go back to the reference. You see gay rights and they want equality in marriage. Well, they had equality. Everyone had the same rights on marriage. What they wanted is they wanted to have different rights. They wanted something else. Now, we can talk about, about whether that's what they're saying is right or wrong. Is that really marriage? Another word we can throw in here probably to discuss is love. But this idea of equality. And it's not that we disagree with equality. As you mentioned, we do think all men are created equal. They're all have the imago Dei, the image of God in them. We are to treat them as humans, as equals. The second greatest commandment is to love your neighbor as yourself. And as Paul or Jesus clearly displays, that everyone's our neighbor. We should treat even those who hate us with kindness with it. But their sense of equality is skewed, to say it. There's not just, we want the same rights as everyone else, but even, it's almost like they equate equality with status quo. like they want to, homosexual marriage should be considered as a status equal to heterosexual marriage. And have these in it. And really to do that, there has to be this actually a more of a promotions. Nothing can be, I guess, truly in that sense, equal within the status quo to think about it. But we also, I think, have to understand that, and this comes from a former pastor, that this kind of idea of equality is or fairness would be another term they use with this, is that these ideas trying to push equality, fairness, is trying to make fair a world that is by nature unfair.
Right. Did I cut you off?
Go ahead.
Okay. So with that, with all Mike said, all really great stuff, the bringing in of the gay marriage issue, those were my thoughts exactly. Everyone did have the same exact right. And so that's the wrinkle with social justice, equity or equality or fairness, as Mike said, is that it's not parity or all things being level playing field. It's some people started lower, and so now we've got to take them and we've got to push them along towards a finish line. Or I really like the way you said, Mike, take it and make it the new status quo. So they perceive gay marriage to have been oppressed, and so they want the new status quo to be homosexual marriage. Or they perceive that there wasn't enough women in the workplace. Now we need only in a majority of women in the workplace as a status quo. Or there wasn't enough blacks or enough Hispanics or enough of this and enough of that. And so now it's these. This has to be the new status quo. And so that's the difference between what we think about as normal. There's a new normal, but as regular thinking people who use the ordinary plain meaning of language versus these new definitions that the cults and the social justice movement will thrust upon us. And so that wraps up that holy trinity of diversity, inclusion, and equity. And these are the justice concept behind social justice. And so to get a glimpse of diversity, inclusion, and equity, of the real biblical definition of all this, my mind was drawn to Acts 10, 34 and 35 earlier today. It says, this is at the conversion of Cornelius, the first major Gentile convert in the book of Acts. Opening his mouth, Peter said, "I most certainly understand now that God is not one to show partiality, but in every nation, the man who fears him and does what is right is welcome to him." The word, and that's it. That's 10:34 and 35. Those from everywhere who fear him are welcome. So this is, and we also see the concept that God doesn't show partiality. And so that's why we know that words that mean not partiality, like equality, are good words. But the problem is, one of the main techniques, and a lot of people use this technique today, it's not just the critical theorists, it's just a poor argumentation technique, but is used a lot of times by the critical theorists, by in the gay movement, Black Lives Matter movement. They'll say things that you can't argue with because they don't want any argument, like Black Lives Matter. If you argue with that phrase, you're racist and you're shut down. And also with gay pride, love is love. Who can argue with that? That's a logical law of identity. You can't argue with that. But go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to think more, you know, when you're talking about equality, it's, you kind of talked about the race. They're trying to make it where everyone wins the race at the same time.
Right.
You know, kind of how you're alluding to. Right. And just kind of think, you know, of another issue you'll hear brought up is women don't get paid the same as men, right. Which there has been studies to show that that depends on your industry. For the most part, not that. And based on the industry, in that men tend to work in industries that pay better than women do. But that when you look at them at the same level, that pay inequality, as they would say, is not there. So there's even, so you can talk, look at, even just looking at the data, how you want to think of that data can cause, you know, the view at it. But just, you know, I guess another example, it's that women should be paid at the same rate as men are in their jobs, which I don't necessarily disagree with. But there's a lot of things that factor into one's pay, including experience and education and other things like reports within the company versus a new hire and in that way. But that women should be fairly compensated for what they do. They shouldn't lose money based on just being a woman, something they can't control. With it, but then that still looks at it. People, there's actually a feminist I was watching basically saying that she thinks female wage inequality is a myth. The data doesn't really support it.
That's astonishing from that standpoint of epistemology.
Yeah. And some of the things she said is, you don't really have a lot of women CEOs, but so because of that, CEOs get paid a lot. And so that would drive kind of this show that inequality. If you just take on an average, what men make across all industries versus what women make versus all industries, you're going to see those. That's where you're going to start seeing some of that inequality. But if you look at women CEOs, they make closely, roughly the same amount as their male counterparts, depending on where they're at in experience. And when you start putting some of these factors in. And so, but to kind of the flip side, and maybe to think about it even on a more conservative political aspect, is that, and to be like that they use equality, I think, differently, but that everyone should have the equal opportunity to succeed.
Right.
They need to have the ability, and that's different.
Right.
You know, someone in a poor neighborhood may have to work really hard, but they shouldn't be automatically given opportunities to exceed with it. But they should have an equal chance to go to a college, provided they, like others, do the work required to get the proper entrance into a college. I think, and that's different. That's a better view, kind of even what you're saying, of equality. Right. That everyone has a chance to do it. And even when we think about the gospel call, we should, when we do that, we're giving people the ability, in a sense, God is equally calling all people to repent and to come. Now, we know that he saves those whom he will save, and he'll do it through that way. But just to consider even more the idea of equality, like with it, that how they apply this understanding is vastly different in how it is. And as you kind of say it, everyone who starts the race has the equal opportunity to win the race.
Right.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that everyone should cross the finish line at the same time.
Right. It's like, instead of the tortoise working hard and consistently to overcome the hare at the beginning of the race, somebody grabs the tortoise and carries him within 10 feet of the finish line. Kind of a thinking. It really is. And that's actually bad for the tortoise, if we're going to stick with the same metaphor, because what happened in the original story, that the hare took a break because he thought he had the race well in hand. How do we know that tortoise isn't going to do the same thing? That's an analogy. You can do what you want with that, but that's kind of what we're thinking. It's, mm-hmm. it's harmful. It's detrimental. We've seen, you can do a little research, many times, certain students will get into certain schools because of certain equity or inclusion measures, and they won't be able to keep up because they weren't ready. And maybe that wasn't the right school for them or the right fit for them. But because of equity and inclusion, they have now been harmed and set back even further because of that. Moving right along, we're at 40 minutes already, and we're only with the first three words. We are moving into number four, justice, and we're going to go through this really quick. We've kind of delved into, with diversity, inclusion, and equity, we've kind of seen the social justice view of justice itself. Typically, the social justice view will have some sort of leg up or as all that we've been discussing, and many times you'll hear about reparations. With it's not enough to be equal. You've got to pay us back for all the unequal that we've had over the years. And so if you notice with critical theory or in our culture right now, so basically if you hear me talk about critical theory, I've talked about social justice. These are the dominant philosophy in our culture right now. So if you don't know what I'm talking about still by this point, these are the dominant. So what you see out there in the world is what I'm talking about. These are technical terms for it. So if you notice with the critical theory or social justice, it's always got something appended in front of the word justice. We saw this over 100 years ago with when liberalism crept into the church. We saw the social gospel, same fight 100 years later, same stuff, different day. And so there's always a little something attached. It's with the Galatians two millennia ago, it was the circumcision gospel. It's 100 years ago, social gospel. Now, instead of justice, it is social justice, racial justice, gender justice, whatever you want to put in front of that justice, income justice. Attach your favorite thing. Get justice for it. That's how this works. So whenever we think about God's justice, very important. This is a very important definition. This is throughout the Bible, but in particular in the Levitical code, in Leviticus 9:19-15, it says, "You shall not do injustice in judgment." So we don't want injustice, neither does God. You shall not do injustice. And what is justice? You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great. but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. And so what this means is that I can't see someone who's poor and say, oh man, this guy's got a really tough time. He's going up against this wealthy magnate and I feel really bad for him. So despite the facts, I'm going to pull the case in favor of the poor fellow. Or same case, and I look at the poor guy, and he gets enough handouts, so I'm going to go ahead and give this one away to the rich. You're not supposed to do either. So justice is having the same standard for everybody. We see this again in James, where it talks about someone who's rich coming into the church, and you say, here, have a nice seat over here. Yet to the poor man, you say, sit by my feet. Over and over again, God does not show partiality, nor does he accept a bribe. And this is the undergirding principle and characteristic of God's justice, is that there is no partiality. Mike?
Yeah, I think about a story again at the same place. I was talking to a guy and this came up. He asked me, what did I think a judge should do? If there are two kids, one was poor and didn't have enough food to be fed, and you have a rich kid who has everything and a full belly and food just completely at his disposal, and they went to a grocery store and they both stole some food. They both get caught. They face the judge. The question is, what should the judge do? And I told him, well, the judge should punish them equally for the crime. They both committed a crime and they should both be found guilty for it if they in fact did it. And he argued, as you were saying, he was trying to argue with me that the judge should look at the circumstances of the poor kid and not punish him, throw the case out, get rid of it, because he needed it. He was hungry. He was, you know, with that. And no doubt, I agreed with him, that's the case. But as you pointed out, we shouldn't be impartial. The poor kid should face the punishment for his crime. Does that mean the judge can't be merciful? Well, no. The judge can still be merciful. And he could say to the poor person, you are guilty of this crime. But understanding, I can have mercy. Which really gets to the heart of the gospel. Because God can send us to hell because we've sinned against him. But he has had mercy for us. And the same can be true here. And I think sometimes, and to think about it, is when they think about justice, they confuse justice with mercy. And that a person deserves mercy because they're oppressed in their language. And, well, that's not it. Lady Justice is blind. Her scales are even. Even when we think about the mob mentality and all the riots to get justice for what has been happening on. Well, that's not justice. Justice is pursuing the case, determining if there was any wrongdoing, and making the proper judgment. It's not vindictive. Justice is equal. And even these reparations, I mean, they're not unbiblical in the sense that if I stole something, I have to pay back what I stole. I have to, if I borrow someone's tool and I break it, I need to repay him back for what I broke. That is just. That is right. No, you don't see, I should as a white person, give money just to black people in general for something I haven't done, because I haven't owned a slave personally. I shouldn't have to pay. That would be an injustice. You're accusing the crime onto someone else. And even the Bible speaks about that, that the father is to face the crime, or the son is to face his own crime, and it shouldn't be put on his father. And so you see here a confusion between justice and mercy within it. And this is not to say that the court systems are just.
Right.
I think we could say here that the court system isn't always just. That judges are partial to maybe give rich people off, certain people off, reduce their sentences because of who they are. Or the fact that people who tend to be rich are able to pay for better lawyers that can get them off than maybe someone who is poorer and doesn't have the money and maybe have to get stuck with a public defender who has multiple cases and can't always devote time. I'm not saying that our system is perfect, but I think when you look at them, they equate or impose mercy with justice, and that we should see that those are separate. That what the poor kid deserves is one thing, but maybe what he receives is another. And this isn't to say that judges can't make calls of mercy. I mean, there's an entire show about a judge on a bench that shows mercy to people. You can watch it. Providence. I think Providence something. You know, I'm not begrudging the judge saying he's unjust. He's merciful. And clearly the people who go in there know they're wrong and should receive what they've received. And so I think that's when we need to consider, we need a solid definition of justice, a justice that is impartial, that seeks to restore order without and be equal, kind of in the actual sense.
Right. And so brings us to racism. Typically, when I think of racism, we've kind of covered some of this already. Partiality. I think of partiality, only this time instead of rich and poor, it is based on skin color. So I don't like whites because they're white, and so I give preference to blacks, or I don't like blacks because they're blacks, and so I give preference to Hispanics, or any number of ways that this can be expressed. And so what we see then is that it turns everything into a thing about your racial identity, it seems like, rather than it's if you didn't give me, if I'm a different, if I am part of the non-dominant group and you didn't give me inclusion, equity, justice, then it's because of my skin tone, rather than something else. You know, it must be because of your skin tone and my skin tone, which could be the case. I mean, actual racism exists. I saw some of it the other day in this idea of partiality, in a thing that a gentleman said in front of me. So we don't want to say that it doesn't exist. However, if I'm not included or given that social equity or the social justice, then it's somehow racially motivated. And in a lot of this, in the social justice discussion, we'll talk about systematic racism. So they'll look at a case of racism that I saw the other day and use that as proof positive of system-wide racism. And so there has been a time in our country long ago, I say long ago because long in the scope of human lifetime, not quite long in maybe even only my young lifetime, there were laws put in place to discriminate against blacks and other ethnicities. And so these laws were part of the system and caused a partiality in the system of racism. And so since then, since that time, since the 13th Amendment, that system of forced chattel slavery based on ethnicity has been abrogated. Since the civil rights era, actually it's debatable, the systematic racism changed a little bit since the civil rights era. It went from exclusion and segregation based on ethnicity to now it's inclusion based on an ethnicity. So if we look in reality, the systematic racism in this country is just flipped. It's partiality in favor instead of partiality against in many circumstances. We mentioned the Rooney Rule, that is a systematic racism in the NFL, though it is racism in favor of instead of racism against. So we do see that. However, Mike, maybe you could speak to this, the variance in the wrinkles.
Yeah, I mean, I think what makes it hard when we think about systemic racism is the fact that institutions or systems are made up of people.
Right.
And can a impersonal system,
right,
be racist, have something against people?
Right.
And so can people in a system be racist and then use that system against people? Mm. Yes. Let's put it out. You know, that's indeed what happened. You can see that with Southern slavery. We see that even in modern day slavery within the sex trade industry, and in that way that there is an institution, but people are using it wrongly. Sinful people are using an institution to get and do their sinful ways and to think about it. But does that inherently make an institution racist? And I think that's where we have to have a proper anthropology and to understand that a system in and of itself cannot be racist.
Right.
But that people can use it to further their racist means.
Mm.
And that, and in that way, and maybe part of that is because we are prejudging people.
Right.
We have prejudice against them. Because when you look at the news, I can say here in Louisville, most of the time they're reporting on crimes, seemingly, at least perceptive, it's usually people of dark skin, black people in that. And so does that mean that the court system is inherently racist because of it? And I think even maybe today it's more prejudices than anything. When you think about the World Trade Centers, people looked at Muslims and Middle Easterners differently. because of the act of a few people. Now, that's, in a sense, we can say that's not being fair to them, because not all people are the same. Not all Muslims are terrorists. And just in the same way that not all black people commit crime. I live in a predominantly black neighborhood in Louisville, and I can tell you that most of my neighbors have not committed a crime that I know of. Like, that's just not who they are. And so to say that an institution is racist, I think wrongly anthropomorphizes a system with it. And this becomes important because when you have Black Lives Matter, you have people who are pushing critical race theory and intersectionality, taking what Marx has said is that you have to topple all these institutions so that the plow person can come to the top, can become one. And this is, you hear it. We have to defund the police. We need to reallocate the funds that normally go to the police department into community activities. We need to change the justice system. We need to do this and do that, and to topple the institutions instead of trying to reform them to make them better. They just destroy them. And that's, I didn't think the big scare was socialism, but the difference between socialism and kind of Marxism is the revolutionary mindset. Fabian socialism is one of infiltration, slow change. Marxism and the communist regime, it's not slow change. It's war. It's you destroy. And we've seen that. You see that in history. That, I mean, the unable just to count how many people have died under socialist or communist regimes who are totalitarian. And these are what these people want. Kind of going off a tangent, so we'll bring it back in. We have to understand that they're using kind of something that, as Vodi Bakum would say, everyone has, just some people have more than others, and using it as a defining aspect to show partiality. And even in the language, racism, when we consider, as we talk about racism, it's a partiality towards one race, so either towards white or to blacks or to the brown, you know, and however you want to do that. But when our culture talks about racism, it is clearly that only white, Caucasian males, European descents, are racist.
Right.
No one else can be. Again, it's that subtle change. Racism is particular to, no matter what Merriam-Webster may say now with the new update, how it's played is, well, and even what the media is, only white people can really be racist. But if you can make, you know, a safe space for African Americans, well, that's not racist, even though you're showing partiality by excluding other people.
Right. Yeah, that is the, so we talk about next on the list is a word's privilege. And so going hand in hand with racism and what you just said there, privilege is defined, according to them, It's not what we think about as these things are nice, life, breath, and all things are privileges given us by God, and nice things to have that we've been given. What a privilege to be here today, et cetera, et cetera. These are privileges is the domination or power position or hegemonic influence, as they call it, which means that my standpoint, my opinion is the dominant opinion. Or so we think about my ethnicity being the white straight male, being the dominant hegemonic influence. So the world is heteronormative, male normative, and white normative. And so that would be the privileged group, the dominant group. And so only the privileged group can be racist is how it's often taken. So someone striving against the privilege, someone in the oppressed group, is unable to be racist. Oppression, typically we don't think of that as actually doing injustice to someone. In critical theory, we think of oppression as not having your viewpoint be the dominant viewpoint and not being part of that group with the hegemonic control. And so it's privilege versus oppression in this system. And that's why you hear things like white privilege or check your privilege, use your privilege to lift those up who are not privileged, is because it's share what you have. You have this privilege, you have this dominant position. And so you need to check that and lower yourself so that you can lift up someone who is oppressed by these injustices. Again, we're not talking about whether actual injustices or oppression exist. We're simply talking about the way words are used within another ideology here.
Yeah. I think if we consider what they said, does this apply to other nations?
Right.
Because we talk about, okay, in America, if you're a white male with some sort of theistic belief, then you're privileged. And
right.
Almost in the sense that everything gets handed to you on a silver platter.
Right.
But is that true in, let's say, China? Does a Chinese male Christian, is he privileged in the same way I am? And are these fluids? Because when you hear him talk about it, this isn't a fluid idea.
Right.
Even though in China, being a Christian means you're going to be oppressed. You're going to, or you have a very real sense that you may be martyred for what you believe. And so when we consider this idea of privilege, it's that idea that as a white male, everything I get, heterosexual male, you even go with it, that everything is handed to me on a pleasure. I don't have to work hard to advance. Even though that, from a standpoint epistemology, isn't true. Stuff isn't handed to me on a platter. And I've had to work to do things. There was times in which I felt that I was being oppressed for one reason or another in previous jobs. And I realized my oppression is different there is levels in which people are oppressed and maybe feel that way. But this idea that just because of I'm a certain demographic means everything's handed to me. It's not. And in fact, if that is such a case, especially when you consider people who are wealthy and the current or those who got caught by having people lie in order to get scholarships and paying people on the side so their child can get into a school that they weren't good enough to get into a school. They didn't have the grades to do it. You know, that's not the case with it. And I have someone I know who went to Harvard. He scored perfect on both his ACT and SAT. Was he privileged? No. Small town Nebraska people. His dad worked in agriculture. His mom was a teacher. They're not, you know, loaded in cash. But he worked hard. And that's, I think, people, again, when with this, is just, there's no individualism. Right. And we've hinted at it. We haven't expressed it. And so the fact that I'm white, male, these categories, that makes me privileged already, even though, as an individual, I have never experienced any type of privilege with it. And so I do think when we consider both of those, that it's not really a standpoint in which it's my view. It's based on these demographics and what I perceive to be it and with it. So now we have hit, we've gone over the 1 hour mark with the show. We should never do a list more than like three.
Yeah, so the first three were kind of key and crucial and kind of all hit. So now I'll wrap it up with the last. We'll skip number nine, gender. That is all part of this. It has a very specific definition. I'll just talk briefly on it. White / person of color, in my estimation, and what it seems is that white and whiteness, you can kind of glean some of this if you read the About section on the Black Lives Matter website. I'd encourage everyone to read that. White is generally oppression, and person of color doesn't mean that they're someone of minority. It means they're oppressed. Very simple concept. So whenever you see someone who's black, white, red, Indian, American Indian, or something, calling them person of color doesn't mean that they're a different color. It means they're oppressed because I have a color too. It's just white. But I am white. I am in the dominant oppressor group. That's a quick definition there. Gender, another thing that's affected by standpoint epistemology. There's gender and grammar, where we have two genders in English, masculine and feminine, generally tied to the sex, male and female. In German, there is masculine, feminine, and neuter. In Spanish, you have things like la mesa, which is the table. Tables have no sex, yet it has a feminine gender. You can also have a cultural gender, which is things like men have long hair or short hair, this day and age, who knows? Men have short hair, women have long hair. You see this in the Bible. It says that women should not wear the things pertaining to a man, or wear, kind of speaking of warriors' clothing, and it is abomination for men to wear women's clothing. So you see this idea of social gender expressly tied to sex. In the critical gender theory, critical race theory, critical theory in general, gender is more of a Gnostic concept based on standpoint epistemology. And I'm the only one who has my lived experience, and I'm the only one who can tell you what my gender identity is. So it could be masculine, could be feminine, could be gender third person omniscient. That's kind of how that works. Reconciliation, just to cap things off, reconciliation, for that to be accomplished, that's our goal. It's a goal in Christianity too. We talk about racial reconciliation, where everything has finally, the tables have been turned. Everything is now equitable. There's enough inclusion and diversity to satisfy the powers that be. And so finally, in critical theory, there's reconciliation when all of this has happened. The problem with that is there's never any finality to it. It's never enough. Just like most false gods, they're like a burning pit that you feed wood into it, and it's a flame that can never be satisfied. It just grows and grows and grows. Whereas in biblical reconciliation, we see things like God giving us the ministry of reconciliation to reconcile, call men to be reconciled both to God and to each other through the Lord Jesus Christ. And this is a final thing through his person and work, his complete person and work. We see that God is reconciling all things to himself, whether things on earth and things in heaven. And so just to cap us off with the last word, it is very important that we stick with the gospel and preach the gospel, because only Jesus has the power to reconcile both God and man. And that's all I have to say about that for now, since we're behind the clock.
Yes. Well, thank you for a quick summation. We probably could have gone on for another 30 minutes or so with that. But that has been this episode. This is episode 436. I don't think it means what you think it means. Next week, we have a pre-recorded episode with George Alvarado. He stepped back in to G220. We reluctantly allowed him back in. I'm just kidding. We didn't. We enjoy George anyway. But we're going to be talking about how we should prepare for the future, especially in light of growing movements that target and want to persecute Christians here in America. It's going to be a great episode. It's going to challenge you in probably ways you didn't think it would. It's really going to just make you feel uncomfortable. I mean, I felt it during the recording with it. So you're going to want to tune in next Tuesday, 9 p.m. and to listen to that episode of G220 Radio. You're not going to want to miss it. It's going to be a good one for it. So with that, we thank you for watching or listening to G220 Radio, however you are digesting this. And join us next week, 9 p.m. And until again, God bless.